is The Trend on WNIN. I'm John Gibson. Thank you for joining us today. We're looking at child abuse today, how to prevent it, how to recognize it, how to help the victims. We'll hear from Sydney Hargrave at Holly's House in Evansville. I also spoke with Angie Richards-Cooley at the ARC Crisis Child Care Center. And we'll hear from Emily Morrison, who heads up the Stewards of Children program at the Lampion Center. Later in the show, we'll switch gears a bit and hear from the president of Indiana University, Michael McRobbie, as he speaks to the Evansville Rotary Club about the planned downtown medical complex. But first, let's check in with Sydney Hargrave at Holly's House. She tells me that the facility helps children testify about abuse in a quiet, safe environment.
We opened our doors a little over 5 years ago, the fall of 2008. And our services were established to address a specific need in the process of investigating child abuse. Prior to Holly's House, there's really two systems that interact with children when abuse is alleged, and that's the criminal justice system and the child protection system. So those agencies would do their investigations, do their work. They were kind of parallel processes. And what professionally we've recognized over time is when a child has been abused and you're asking them to recount those details, you are emotionally traumatizing them again. Mm-hmm. It's just human nature. When you remember a bad experience, you emotionally have some of those same emotions. Mm-hmm. So the concept of a child's advocacy center, which is the model Holly's House was structured around, is to really bring all of those teams together. Provide an opportunity to interview the child, which does need to happen, but to do it in an environment that's very sensitive to that child's emotional needs, and to conduct that interview in a way that one interview will meet the needs of both systems. I see. So that we aren't bringing children back repeatedly to tell the same story. Right. It would be nice, of course, if we could spare them all of the trauma of having to be interviewed, but often in child abuse, the only people who really know what happened is the child and the suspect in that case. So right. We do need to hear from them what has occurred so we can verify if abuse happened. Then the second step at Holly's House is really to work with our community partners and ensure that that family is connected with resources for their healing journey. Mm-hmm. That might be medical care, that might be mental health services, advocacy services. Sometimes it's safe shelter, sometimes it's basic needs like food and clothing. Right. So while the family's here, we're also going to just, see what additional resources are going to help them through this experience and just make sure that those resources are available and appropriate referrals are made. Mm-hmm. Although Holly's House was founded on the children advocacy model, we do have a parallel set of services for adult victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. So that logic of providing a single interview in an environment that's welcoming and safe and relaxing is important, I think, for any victim of intimate crime. Yeah. We at Holly's House primarily are serving children who are involved in an allegation of child sexual abuse, however. Right. And that's when our method seems to be relied upon the most.
This new facility, this method, how has it affected, say, the number of charges and convictions? Has that number gone up mm-hmm. since the Holly's House started mm-hmm. doing its thing?
Yeah, it's actually hard to get a number on convictions in that we're still a young agency, and mm-hmm. often the process from first report to final sentencing can be multiple years. So. Mm-hmm. A lot of the cases we have worked are still in process through the criminal justice system. But we do know that we get a high level of what we call disclosures. That's the child reporting something that does constitute abuse. Generally, kind of a nationwide, regardless of a children advocacy center, about one quarter of investigations result in the substantiation of child abuse. At Holly's House, our interviews result in substantiation between 50 and 60% of the time. Mm-hmm. So I think that supports the idea of giving a child a safe, comfortable environment to be interviewed in. Mm-hmm. Of course, the strength of those interviews does lend itself to the strength of building a criminal case.
Right. Only one interview.
Right, a single interview.
Repeated interviews, which used to happen in the past.
Right, yeah, a single interview, which it is recorded, and that lets the investigative teams have access to that. So again, we're not bringing a child back. If one investigator starts a case and maybe they go on a leave, another person has that case file, they can view that interview. They're not going to bring the child back to start over at square one. Mm-hmm. And of course, a child's ability to recount what happened has a strong influence on negotiations within the criminal justice system.
Right.
A trend that we're concerned about with child abuse is that predators are increasingly approaching younger and younger children. And there's a perception that those children are not good witnesses. So from a predator's frame of mind, they really are trying to identify victims who can't speak up for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our ability to do a solid, thorough interview with a child of almost any age, you know, that's part of that answer of holding those predators accountable and demonstrating that these children are very capable of sharing what happened to them and speaking up for themselves.
You mentioned, you know, verifying, you know, whether abuse happened or not. Is there some concern that some of the children, you know, may have been coached or may, for one reason or another, may not be telling the truth? Perhaps it's imagination. How do you get to the bottom of that and make sure you're not accusing someone innocent?
We actually have a very valid interview process. Holly's House uses a method called finding words, which is used in many locations throughout the country. And my first response, my gut response is children don't lie about abuse. I don't think children lie unless they have been coached.
Right.
Now, occasionally we see situations, you know, a custody matter or something where there is an adult telling a child what they need to say because of some other agenda that's going on. We do not see that very often. But when we do, our method actually helps to clarify what would be a true report versus a coached report. Through the process that we use, we are able to determine when a child has been coached. And so, again, it's a valid process from both perspectives to determine if abuse occurred, but also to determine when a child's being encouraged to report something that did not happen.
So you feel confident that you can detect those?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
All right. Well, I guess, as you mentioned, you're not really, you don't have any firm numbers because the agency is kind of new.
Yeah.
But do you feel that maybe more cases are being solved because of this, you know, as opposed to before when maybe, you know, the system just wasn't set up to catch as many?
I think that one number I can share, Holly's House has interviewed over 2,400 potential victims since we opened. So their facility, the program is certainly being used. We are reaching now 9 counties in Southwest Indiana. So we work with partners all the way north to Knox County, all the way east to Perry County. So there's definitely, I think, a need for what happens here. And are we doing a better job? I think systemically we are always growing and improving. You know, we do work closely with the criminal justice system. We work closely with the child protection system. The other aspect of our services that I think is having an impact in our community is our prevention program. And so shortly after Holly's House opened, well, about a year or so after we opened, we were reviewing our own statistics. We were seeing that over 60% of the children we interviewed were elementary school age or younger. And that stimulated a conversation about what kind of information do young children have in relation to protecting their own personal safety.
So are you folks going out to schools with
yes.
this prevention program?
Yeah, and so we adopted a program called Think First and Stay Safe, and we implemented that program in April of 2010. Since that time, we have taught it to over 13,000 elementary school age children in our region. That's a program reaching Posey, Gibson, Vandenberg, and Warwick counties. What's exciting to us about this program, one, we're giving children good information about their personal safety. The program is structured to talk to children about the lures or the tricks that an adult would use when they're trying or intending to hurt that child. For us, this is a really important message. We chose this program in part to counter the message of stranger danger. And for years, we've talked to our children about strangers. the reality is that 96% of the children who come to Holly's house and abuse is verified, they've been hurt by someone they know. Yeah. So if we're talking to young children about stranger danger, and that's all they're hearing, we are not preparing them adequately for their reality.
That's a very small percentage.
It's a very small percentage. And, you know, and when we're out in the schools, I mean, kids are worried about stranger abduction and things that they see on television, but, you know, that's not the reality. The reality is people hurting children are people who are in those children's lives with permission. They're people who those children thought they could trust. And so this prevention program really targets giving children a toolkit, so to speak, of how to identify when a person's behavior is what we call stormy. We use a lesson where we equate for the children the idea of sunny weather and stormy weather. And when the weather's stormy, you go to a safe place, you seek shelter, you seek assistance. So we're classifying these specific behaviors or lures as stormy behavior. So when children encounter someone with stormy behavior, then we're reinforcing that they must engage a trusted adult. We don't expect children to solve the problem of child abuse. But if they don't talk to an adult, then that situation's not going to get better. Through this program, a number of children have come forward after our classes to talk about abuse who previously were keeping that situation a secret. And we've also developed some testimonials of children who later encountered a lure and knew how to react and reacted in the way that we've instructed them to. And so we're very excited in terms of, again, minimizing, when we're talking about Child Abuse Prevention Month, minimizing the number of children whose lives are touched by abuse. We have a long way to go. Estimates about child sexual abuse specifically are that 1 in 10 children will experience sexual abuse before the age of 18. So we have a lot of work to do.
Is that number going up, going down, or has it been about the same?
It is better. When I first started here, the kind of standard statistic in the field was 1 in 4 female children would be sexually abused and 1 in 6 male children. So they've kind of collapsed that statistic and they're saying 1 in 10, which is progress. Absolutely. And we celebrate that. It tells us that, you know, nationwide, these prevention efforts are working. We do know when children are well informed, they can make good decisions. And so our goal is to get correct information to those children. The broader statistic of child abuse in general, nationwide, there are 6 incidents of child abuse reported every minute. And this would include physical, sexual, and neglect. So again, this idea of prevention is so important in that we need our whole community to work together to ensure children are environments where they're safe, that there are adults around them who know how to protect them, and that there are resources to help them heal if something tragic does happen.
That's Sydney Hargrave at Holly's House. You can learn more about Holly's House at hollyshouse.org. You're listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Now we turn to another local agency that helps kids when their family is in crisis.
Got quite an arm, doesn't she?
She does. Definitely.
Right, let me go over here and get these.
Go down there.
That's the sound of kids playing outside on a sunny spring day at the ARC Crisis Child Care Center. You might call it a daycare center for families in crisis. I know the kids were having fun. I sat down with the head of ARC, Angie Richards-Cooley.
ARC is the piece of the puzzle that helps with prevention. We give kids a safe place to be when their families are going through stress or crisis, so the parents can go and take care of whatever it is and leave the kids in a safe place. That word stress is really important to abuse and neglect. When you can remove stress from a family, you can often reduce the likelihood of abuse and neglect. It's the primary common factor in most cases of abuse and neglect.
I see.
Now, are some of the children you have here, have they been abused themselves?
Yeah, we do have a variety of kids who are here. We have several kids who come here who have been abused, who have been neglected, who may be involved in the Department of Children's Services. They may be in foster care. They may have been placed with someone else. We've got a number of kids who've been reunited with their families after their families have gone through some counseling and some parenting skills. We've got a lot of kids who come here really as a measure of prevention. You know, it's tough to be a parent, and sometimes parents don't have a support system to help them. We try and step in that way. So when families are kind of at the end of their rope, when parents just need a break, they can bring them to ARC. One other thing we do that's really important is when children are removed from homes by the police or by DCS, you say they bust a meth lab and they've got kids in the home. They don't have a playroom at the police department for these kids, so they bring them to ARC until they can find an appropriate family member or a foster family for those kids.
So is the eventual goal to either reunite them with their parents or, as you say, another family member?
I think that that's a question that the courts battle with all the time. They try and keep families together. We try and give families a safe place for their kids so we can help facilitate that. But in the cases where kids are removed, we work really closely with foster families to make sure that those kids have a place of stability. If they've been with us before, we want to make sure they're still able to come to us because the kids are going through so many changes that if they can have that one place that's their safe, special place that they can have as a constant through all of those transitions, we want to make sure that we're there.
How many kids do you generally see come through?
We can see up to 53 kids per day, and that's after our expansion that was completed in December. And so we'll see somewhere around 2,000 children a year. So we don't see the same kids every day. We see them when their families are going through things that they need some assistance with. They'll come here for a little while. They may leave. They may come back. It just sort of depends on their family circumstance.
So 2,000 a year, I think folks might be surprised to hear that many.
Yeah, it's a big number, but you know, when we consider that we serve that many kids, we also have a waiting list of about 2,000 other kids who are waiting for services. So it's one of those things where we could be twice as big as we are, and there would probably still be a need for ARC.
What's a typical day like here at ARC for the kids and the staff?
Whenever I say that we don't have a typical day, that's absolutely true. Kids come in, come and go as their family schedules need. So we don't insist that everyone is here by 8 o'clock. We don't insist that everyone leave by 5. They can come and go to fit their family schedule. But kids all come in. They all are treated well. They are all loved. They're all hugged, given plenty of attention. They get free breakfast, free lunch, a free afternoon snack. We follow a curriculum like any other traditional preschool or early childhood program would. They have a nap time. We have one thing that's a little different is we don't do field trips. We can't take our kids anywhere else, but we can we bring those field trip experiences to them. So we call them in-house adventures. So our kids really get that whole preschool and early childhood education experience, but they just may not get it every day.
Right. So what ages do you work with here?
We see kids between the ages of 6 weeks and up to their sixth birthday, when there are some other great community partners who can step in at that age.
I see. And you don't keep kids here overnight?
We do not. We're open from 7:30 until 5, Monday through Friday, year-round.
Okay. And I'm guessing there are shelters that are available for maybe some of these cases?
That's right. We have a number of great community partners. Evansville is so lucky to have such a great safety net of other organizations that all fit into that piece of the puzzle to keep kids and families safe. We're one piece of that, but we couldn't do what we do without some other great community partners. And we do work closely with those domestic violence and homeless shelters to make sure that their kids have priority placement here at ARC.
These kids coming in, a lot of them, as you say, facing stressful situations, it's going to get emotional from time to time, huh?
It does. ARC is a really special place, and for people to work here, they have to be special people. It's really tough. I think a lot of teachers really enjoy bonding with kids and seeing them all year long, getting them ready for kindergarten. Our teachers don't get that luxury, but they also get to know that at the end of the day, they have given something to a child and to that family that they couldn't have gotten elsewhere. They're giving them safety, some peace of mind, and lots of love and attention.
All right. Well, Angie, anything else to add that we haven't touched on here?
Just that all of ARC services are entirely free to any family. There are no limitations except for the age of the children about bringing your kids here. So we try and be as available as we can for any family in need at any time.
I guess donations, volunteers help keep it going?
Those are absolutely critical to what we do. Without community support, without corporate support, without grants and funders and special events, we wouldn't be here. And so really, it's only through the generosity of this community that we've been able to serve children and families for 32 years.
That's Angie Richards-Cooley at the ARC Crisis Child Care Center. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak to Emily Morrison at the Lampion Center. And later in the program, we'll continue our coverage of the IU Med School Project with Indiana University President Michael McRobbie. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. Stay with us.
Support comes in part from Rabin Tire and Auto Service, a proud sponsor of WNIN programming. Rabin offers a selection of tire brands including Michelin and Goodyear, along with complete auto service and recommended maintenance by trained technicians. Information on the web at RabinTire.com.
Trend. Welcome back to The Trend. I'm John Gibson. We're talking about child abuse, how to prevent it, how to recognize it, and how to help its victims. I spoke to Emily Morrison at the Lampion Center in Evansville this week. That's where she heads up the Stewards of Children program.
Lampion Center is a not-for-profit counseling agency here in Evansville, and we support families through all different kinds of, you know, life changes that might occur. So people can come to us for a variety of reasons. It might be that they're having some depression, having some other issues with behavior or relationships, those kinds of things, and they can come to us to receive some support for that.
Support and therapy?
Yes, sir.
What kind of therapy, what kind of services do you provide in that area?
Well, right now we have 7 outpatient therapists, and you know, we have a wide variety of things that they specialize in, you know, from very, very young children to adults and all of the issues that come along with all those life stages. Mm-hmm. We also do, in addition to therapy, we have some programs in some of the local schools to help support the students. Additionally, we do some other community services such as parenting education mm-hmm. that help people through those kinds of parts of their life, too.
Yeah. Well, we're looking, of course, at child abuse and preventing child abuse, of course. So you have programs, I'm guessing, that that do exactly that, I would think, try to prevent such incidents, right?
Yes. We strongly support, and we want to get as many people trained in the community in the Stewards of Children program that we offer. And what that does, it offers people 5 simple steps in which they can either prevent or really responsibly react to suspicions of child sexual abuse right here in our community.
In a nutshell, what are those 5 main areas that you would be teaching people about?
Okay. Well, we teach people about just kind of the simple fact that it is an issue, and it's an issue in our community and in every community and something that they need to be aware of. Mm-hmm. We also want to talk to people about how they can minimize the opportunity for their children for them to be victimized in that sort of way. So we look at assessing the environments for where their children are during the day, whether that be sports teams or daycares or church programs, those kinds of things, to make sure that they're safe areas. We want to teach families how to talk about sexual abuse, how to talk about sexuality with their kids, how to make that a more comfortable and accessible topic for families to discuss mm-hmm. so that it's not so hard if something were to happen. Your children know that it's a safe thing to talk about and report. We talk about the signs and symptoms that people can look for, so at least some of those red flags, so that you can kind of look at context and look at something's going on. Let's see what that might be. And then we want to talk to people about how they can react when they do think something has happened with regards to sexual abuse. And that means, you know, reporting to the proper authorities, even when you have a suspicion, even if you don't know that something for sure has happened.
Right.
But once you are armed with those signs and, you know, some of the other facts about child sexual abuse, you can make a better assessment and actually report so that investigation can occur.
Yeah.
Along with that, sometimes you're not exactly sure what's going on, but you see maybe some boundary violations that are a little bit iffy. And so we talk to families about how to spot those and how to deal with those. So at least people know if somebody was going to try and do something to your child, at least they know you're on the watch.
Right, right. What are some of those red flags? I mean, I'm sure there are plenty, maybe several that, but what are some of the more common signs or maybe, you know, signs of trouble that, that folks, you know, should know about?
You know your children better than anybody else, you know, as a parent. And so when you see their behavior changing drastically, a child who was really super outgoing and they're more withdrawn now, you know, even though that's not a direct sign of child sexual abuse, you know, when taken in with other signs and symptoms, you can see that something's going on. But that's a very common thing. Obviously, there might be physical signs that they notice with their child, you know, difficulty urinating, obviously sexually transmitted diseases, those kinds of actual physical signs that they can investigate further if they've been in a place where maybe you weren't observing them with another adult or an older child.
Mm-hmm.
Other kinds of things, you know, you might notice that the language they use, or the way that, you know, if they're saying things that are have a sexual undertone that aren't the words you normally use in your own household.
Things that have come out of nowhere.
Yes, yes. Or if they're acting out sexually in a way that they haven't seen in your household, or they shouldn't have that kind of sexual knowledge, mm-hmm. then you know they've seen that somewhere and you're going to want to know where that came from.
Yeah. The Stewards of Children program, has it grown? Has it changed? Has it been effective?
Well, I think it's been really effective. You know, we started offering Stewards of Children back at the end of 2008 to the community where, you know, our agency became trained to facilitate the program. And so since 2008, we probably have over 2,500 people in our own community who have been trained to look for the signs and to kind of understand the scope of the problem, which is fantastic because we want as many adults in our community as possible. But with only 2,500, obviously there's a whole lot more room for people to become involved and get that information. So we want to extend that invitation out there. And so for those people who have already even received the program, it's been revamped a little bit this year. So it's offering some more newer information and things that maybe hadn't been considered before. And so we would want to invite everybody to get that information as well. But we're doing pretty good. So far this year, we've had about 250 people trained, and we've got some things on the horizon coming up with specific groups. And so we're always open to people calling us and asking us if we can facilitate for a group that they belong to. One of the things that we have been doing more recently, which is really incredible, is finding ways to partner with people where the group is already there, but they're a child-serving group. For example, we have partnered with USI's nursing department and Ivy Tech. And so now those particular instructors have made it part of their curriculum as the nurses go out because they know they're going to be working in clinics and with families
right.
to be more responsive and alert to those kinds of issues before they even get out of nursing school. And so we see students, you know, every year now going through that program.
The Stewards of Children program, is it sort of a classroom setting? I mean, how would you describe it for somebody who might be interested in trying it?
Usually it's a small group, 12, 15 people, but I can, you know, train as many as we can get in the room.
Mm-hmm.
But it is video driven. And so what happens is we all get together. There's some great materials that the people get to keep and go through while we're doing the program. But you're hearing from professionals in the field. You're hearing from advocates. You're hearing from law enforcement and clergy and coaches on this video telling their story. But you're also hearing about those five steps from the eyes of adult survivors of sexual abuse. So when you can hear those stories, it's very compelling, and it's really hard to deny that there truly is a problem. And I think that it's been really easy for so many years for people to say, it's not happened in my family, and therefore it's not that big of a problem. But when we talk about 1 in 10 children who are going to be sexually abused before they turn 18, you can't deny that. And so look at any group of children that you have and take that count. You know, and think also of the adults. You know, that goes to say that 1 in 10 adults that you meet may have a history of child sexual abuse as well.
Right. Anything surprise you when you train the adults? Are you surprised at maybe some things they don't know about in this area?
Okay. You know, one of the things that people are, you know, I think that people have the idea first that it doesn't happen to people like me or you, you know, but child sexual abuse, it really has no race, no class, you know, no social standing. It happens across the board. One of the big things that we know is that it happens far more often with people that we know and trust than with the strangers that are lurking around, you know, waiting for an opportunity. You know, it is people in our families. It is people who know us. It is people who make it their business to get to know us and befriend us so that they have that opportunity to victimize children. Yeah. And our alert is up for strange people who, you know, you can see from a distance, like, I don't want to be around them. Our alert is not up for people that we know who might want to do harm to our families.
As I understand, the vast majority of these incidents are by people that the family knows, correct?
Yeah, 90% of the time, it's somebody that the family knows or trusts. About 40% of the time, it is a family member. One of the other things that people don't really think about is that sometimes child sexual abuse is perpetrated by an older, stronger child. And so it's not only adults that, you know, are committing this crime, but, you know, there are kids who victimize other children. Now, that's not for me to say that, you know, generally my belief is that if there's a child who is acting out sexually on another child, that has been done to them as well. And so you've got, in those kinds of cases, usually 2 victims that we need to get to the bottom of, you know, to make sure that everybody is safe, that everybody is learning proper boundaries, and that we can put interventions into place so that everybody can be healthy.
You talk a lot about, you know, victims who are now adults and then maybe perhaps their children. There seems like there's a bad cycle there. I mean, as far as it carrying on from generation to generation, do you see a lot of that?
Well, I can say that probably the majority of adults who perpetrate have been sexually abused, but we have to be really, really careful not to turn that around and think that most people who have been victimized go and do that as well. Right. It's a different kind of thing. What we do know is, and another reason this is a great training for anybody to have, is that the earlier we can find a problem and detect that there is an issue, the earlier we can put supportive services in for the children who have been hurt, the more that we can believe the children who are making these reports, the better the outcomes. So, you know, we want to be able to detect things early. We want to be able to put in resources for families that are struggling with this. And, you know, first and foremost, we want to believe our children and be able to take them out of risky situations. And when we can do that, the outcomes are fantastic.
Right. In terms of child abuse in general, does it seem to be, you know, do you see some progress there? Are incidents going down, going up, about the same, or is it hard to tell?
Well, sometimes it's hard to tell because I know that the more we get information out, that tends to help, you know, eliminate the problem a little bit. But right. Also, reporting then goes up because sure. We're encouraging people to report.
Right.
And so, you know, the statistics that we use can sometimes be a little fuzzy in terms of how we make those statistics. So, you know, a couple of years ago, the standard statistic was one in four girls and one in six boys are going to be sexually abused before they turn 18. Now they're saying one in 10. Mm-hmm. But then we have to ask, what does that mean? Because these are the one in 10 does not count non-contact acts. And so it would only be actual physical touching kinds of acts of abuse. But we know that sexual abuse goes beyond just that simple act of touching penetration. It's, you know, giving children access to pornography. It's, you know, videotaping children. And those kinds of things can also be sexual abuse as well. So those numbers can sometimes be deceiving one way or the other, depending on how you're looking at them.
All right. Well, anything else to add? Are you hopeful in the work that you do that obviously, like you say, you're making progress and you hope to stamp out as much or prevent as much of it as possible?
Well, sure. I'm super hopeful. I tell you, one of the things that we've been able to do a really good job of is to be able to give this program to folks in our community, like educators and people who work in child cares and ministry work and those kinds of things. Where we've been less successful, but where I just kind of want to put out the plug, is, you know, if your child care has been trained in stewards of children, wouldn't it be wonderful if the parents of the children who go to that child care could also receive the training so that they're better consumers? For all of the coaches in town to form some trainings so that we can let them know about this problem and how to provide a safe environment, and also invite those parents. So we want to try and boil it down even further, not just to the people that are caring for kids, but for people that are using services where, you know, kids are. Mm-hmm. And so I'll encourage anybody who would like to form a group, I'm happy to go and provide that training. We have generous funding from Welborn Baptist Foundation and from the state of Indiana to be able to provide this program and the materials free of charge. And so we work out a time, we work out the group, and I'm happy to bring that to people in our catchment area is Vandenberg, Warwick, and Posey counties right now. But I can also help other people get that training from other providers outside that area.
That's Emily Morrison, rather, at the Lampion Center in Evansville. Well, we'll take a break and we'll switch gears. Normally, we just cover one topic on the trend, but coming up, we will hear from Indiana University President Michael McRobbie about the IU Medical School project in downtown Evansville. That's a topic, of course, that we're continuing to cover here at WNIN-FM. We'll hear from President McRobbie in just a moment. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. Stay with us.
Support comes from Evansville Day School, presenting their Summer Academy, an educational and enrichment program, offering various themes, workshops, and sports clinics each week. Summer Academy is open to all area students from preschool through college. Half day, full day, and extended care options are available. Details at 812-476-3039 or www.evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. And now we hear from Indiana University President Michael McRobbie. He visited Evansville this week for the first time since the IU Board of Trustees chose a downtown location for a new medical school. He spoke before the Evansville Rotary Club.
I think your service to the community underscores the fact that Evansville is a city with a rich and vibrant history as well as a very bright future. The Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra, the Civic Theatre, the Evansville Dance Theatre, all of these and others contribute to the city's vibrant arts community. The Ford Centre is bringing people from all over the region to downtown Evansville for sporting events and concerts, including, of course, the Hoosiers, who played a game here in the last year. And the revitalized riverfront, the magnificent riverfront that you have here, and many other downtown construction projects have reaffirmed the commitment of local and national industry to this region. And of course, the growth that we have seen in this region is no accident. It is the result, rather, of a great deal of strategic thought and action over many years by so many of you who are here today. The Growth Alliance for Greater Evansville has helped to lead these efforts and has, in the last 2 or 3 years alone, worked on projects that have added nearly 2,000 jobs to the region and has had an economic impact that's measured around $1 billion. And as the business corridor along I-69 continues to develop, ultimately reaching Bloomington in 2015, new opportunities for economic development and for the development of new potential partnerships will also continue to arise. And of course, our students, our alumni, and our sports fans truly look forward to the completion of the highway, which will allow for much safer travel from Evansville to the Bloomington campus and beyond, which will take only about an hour and 40 minutes. IU is truly delighted to have been part of the growth of Evansville and the resurgence of the downtown area with the development of the new Academic Health Centre, Education and Research Centre. As Pat has often pointed out, Evansville is Indiana's third largest city. Yet southwestern Indiana is the only part of the state where IU has not had a major presence. The new Health Sciences campus, which will greatly expand the medical education and research efforts of the IU School of Medicine in Evansville, will rectify this situation. The history of the IU School of Medicine at Evansville dates back to 1972, when the school had a presence on the campuses of both the University of Evansville and the University of Southern Indiana. And for the last 20 years, of course, the program has been housed in the Health Professions Center on the campus of the University of Southern Indiana. And I'm very pleased that Dr. Steve Becker, the Associate Dean and Director of the IU School of Medicine Evansville, is also with us today. IU is proud of the successful partnership that has allowed many students to receive education through the IU School of Medicine here in Evansville. We are, as always, grateful for the support and service of more than 180 area physicians who volunteer their time in the school's educational programs. And beginning this year, the Evansville campus will provide 4 years of medical education training. But as was revealed in a very thoughtful study that was conducted in 2012, there was a great need for expanded medical education in southwest Indiana. Even though Vandenberg County, in the important role that it serves as a healthcare center for the entire region, has very good access to physicians and to hospitals, primary care practices in the region are at or near capacity. Moreover, at current graduation and training rates, there will be 45,000 too few primary care physicians in the US by 2020. 45,000. And this is according to the Association of American Medical Colleges Center for Workforce Studies. These, of course, are the very doctors who provide the preventative screenings and treatments that save lives and mitigate the frequency of expensive emergency room visits and of hospitalizations. A number of years ago, the IU School of Medicine assembled an expert task force to study the looming shortage of healthcare providers and to make recommendations. They concluded that the IU School of Medicine would need to increase its enrollment of medical students by 30% to ensure an adequate supply of Indiana doctors in the coming two decades. One of the ways the school is endeavoring to accomplish this increase is to transform the regional medical education programs from 2-year to 4-year programs, as has been done here, for example, in Evansville. The Evansville Health Science Education and Research Campus will serve approximately 1,800 students when it opens. Many of these students will remain in the region, and thus the centre will help to address the acute shortage of primary care physicians and other healthcare professionals. As you know, at their April meeting, on my recommendation, the IU trustees approved a site for the new $69.5 million building, the 170,000 square foot building here in downtown Evansville, which of course is adjacent to the planned new Convention Center Hotel. The new facility will be a major component of your revitalized waterfront, which provides a really wonderful, attractive setting right here in the center of the city. As I said to the trustees when I made my recommendation, each of the four qualifying proposals were evaluated and were of the very highest quality. And this made arriving at a recommendation extremely difficult. The experience and the depth of knowledge of the members of the teams behind each proposal were clearly evident. And I truly believe that the facility would be successful in any one of the four proposed sites. We ultimately recommended the downtown location based on strong student preferences that were expressed, the recommendations of the local hospital leadership, and the input we received from our academic partners, including Vice President Jay Hess, the Dean of the IU School of Medicine. The site provides a central location, one that is accessible to all of Evansville's medical facility assets. The proposed design creates a strong presence in a quickly developing downtown and is preferred by an overwhelming number of the parties who will utilize and benefit from this facility. IU is delighted at the prospect of having a greater presence in Southwest Indiana and equally pleased to be part of the ongoing revitalization of downtown Evansville. Of course, we have by no means reached this point alone. The process of planning for this expanded medical education campus in Evansville has truly been a broad-based partnership, and the work going forward will also be likewise. And let me express on behalf of IU our gratitude to our partner institutions. The leaders of the University of Southern Indiana, University of Evansville, and Ivy Tech Southwest had the vision to recognize the needs of the Evansville region and to work collectively with the IU School of Medicine, with each institution drawing upon its particular strengths to create a solid framework for the delivery of academic programs and research in the health sciences. Let me once again thank President Bennett and the University of Southern Indiana for fostering the long-standing partnership that exists today between the IU School of Medicine and USI. The new multi-institutional partnership has its roots in the success over many years of our partnership with USI. And indeed, were it not for this partnership, the development of a plan for expansion of academic and collaborative health sciences delivery in the Evansville region would not have been possible. Input from members of the business community, healthcare providers, and representatives from our partners at Deaconess Health, St. Mary's Health, and Memorial Hospital and Healthcare Centre has been and will continue to be crucial to the development of what truly will be a distinctive life and health sciences resource for Southwest Indiana. Many of you in this room have been instrumental in helping to develop this vision for the new Medical Education Center over the past 3 years. And I'm grateful for the work of the four different local working groups who have helped guide the site selection, the funding, the academic research and communication priorities, all of which have helped to guide our success. The Evansville Regional Business Committee, a group of whose members I've had the pleasure of consulting for sound advice and council on previous occasions, recognized the potential of the new centre and provided key funding for the important feasibility studies. We're also deeply grateful to the City of Evansville for financial incentives that will help make the new health sciences campus possible. This combined $35 million support package represents the largest amount of local government support, financial support for one project in the history of Indiana University. And we very much appreciate the confidence of the Evansville community in this project as is expressed through these incentives. I know that many of you are here today, were instrumental in developing this vision for the Regional Health Education Center, and I want to express my deep gratitude and the deep gratitude of all at IU for all that you did to make this possible. Your efforts will dramatically increase medical and health-related educational opportunities for students in southwestern Indiana and northwestern Kentucky, and they will have an enormous impact on this region for many, many years to come. Of course, the educational research and clinical activities of Indiana University's health sciences and clinical schools which include the IU schools of medicine, nursing, dentistry, optometry, social work, and health and rehabilitation science, are one of the major ways in which IU contributes to the social and economic development of the state of Indiana. Over 50% of Indiana's physicians, 40% of the nurses, 90% of the dentists, and 60% of the state's optometrists are trained at IU. IU's impact is amplified even further by its close partnership with Indiana University Health, the state's most comprehensive healthcare system. IU Health, which fully integrates the research and clinical expertise of the IU School of Medicine, continues to be ranked among the most highly regarded healthcare systems in the nation and among the very top hospitals in Indiana. IU has also launched a major effort to address our state's very poor rankings among all states in measures of the leading causes of death and illness, as well as measures of the determinants of health, through the establishment of two new schools of public health, the Fairbanks School of Public Health on our Indianapolis campus and the School of Public Health at IU Bloomington. These two new schools have as their central mission the improvement of public health by conducting research of the highest quality and by educating the next generation of public health professionals. These two new schools are in turn emblematic of the growth and change that we are seeing across Indiana University. Our new academic directions report, which was a report was submitted in 2011, has produced strategic and focused changes of an unprecedented scale in the academic landscape of IU's core campuses in Bloomington and Indianapolis. In addition to the two new schools of public health that I just mentioned, four additional new schools were established in response to the report's recommendations. These include the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy on the Indianapolis campus, which is the first school in the world dedicated to the academic study of philanthropy in all its diverse and multidisciplinary manifestations. The School of Global and International Studies, which brings together IU's extraordinary strengths in global and international scholarship. A newly configured School of Informatics and Computing, which now includes our previous School of Library and Information Science, and a new media school within the College of Arts and Sciences, which will officially come into existence on July the 1st. The media school, by the way, will merge our programs in journalism, telecommunications, communication and culture, and in film studies. And I should also mention that our film studies program is rapidly emerging as one of the most prominent in the nation, and the Bloomington campus, just a few weeks ago, was privileged to host a visit by Meryl Streep, to whom we awarded an IU doctorate, honorary doctorate, who was, I think it's fair to say, widely regarded as the greatest actor of her generation and quite possibly of all times.
That's Indiana University President Michael McRobbie speaking to the Evansville Rotary Club in Evansville this week. Of course, IU plans to build a medical complex downtown. McRobbie got his first look at the site this week while visiting local officials. That medical complex is scheduled to open in fall of 2017. Well, thanks for joining us on The Trend today. I'd like to thank my guests, Sydney Hargrave at Holly's House, Angie Richards-Cooley at the ARC Crisis Child Care Center, Emily Morrison at the Lampion Center, and, of course, IU President Michael McRobbie. Also, a big thanks to Daniel Moore and Steve Berger for engineering today's program. I'm John Gibson. We appreciate you joining us. Be sure to join us again next week for another episode of The Trend. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. With your continuing support, we're building a better tri-state together. Have a good day.